your fault. Baby, it's not mine. Our chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make dab in the middle of it. Grass make dab in the middle. We are grass make dab in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The Secret Truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Boy, we have one of the finest guests we've ever had with us this evening. And he's Roger Stone. And let me tell you about, he's the author of The Making of the President, 2016, How Donald Trump Orchestrated a Revolution. And President Donald J. Trump calls him a tough cookie, and Roger Stone is one tough cookie. He's a seasoned political operative and pundit, a veteran of 9 national presidential campaigns. He served as a senior campaign aide to 3 Republican presidents, an outspoken libertarian. He's the author of New York Times bestseller, The Man Who Killed Kennedy, The Case Against LBJ, and has written for Fox Opinion, Breitbart News, Stone Zone, .com, The Daily Caller, and op-ed page of the New York Times. He's a well-known voice in politics for over 40 years, and so he speaks with authority. Roger Stone also gives insights on behind-the-scenes political agendas on Fox News and InfoWars, and he's been banned by CNN. I think that's actually good. Welcome to our program, Roger Stone. Being banned by those people is good today, is it not?
Yeah, now I wear it like a badge because particularly of all these faux media outlets, CNN is the worst. I mean, folks, stop claiming to be a news organization. You're not a news organization. You're an opinion organization. Now you're entitled to put on TV whatever you want, but just make it clear it's not necessarily true. It's fake news. It's your opinion, not what's really happening.
You started writing this book. How long ago did it take you?
Well, I always thought I would write a book about Donald Trump. Our relationship goes back almost 40 years. So I started keeping string, as they say in this business, and making notes and so on. And then I resolved on the Sunday before the election, when it became absolutely clear to me, based it on studying a lot of sophisticated polling data, that Trump was going to win. It was then that I resolved to get the book out first and best on this election. And I must tell you, in order to do so, I figured out I had to write approximately 2,000 words a day, which means if I didn't make my 2,000 words on a Monday, then it meant on Tuesday I had to write 4,000 words to make up for it. And that was the only way I would make his my publication date. I was, as you know, very ill for several weeks, almost 3 weeks, the result of an attempt by someone to poison me. I know some in the elitist mainstream press make light of this and say it's some kind of publicity stunt to sell books. Well, I was perfectly healthy during the time I made the New York Times bestseller list with The Man Who Killed Kennedy, The Case Against LBJ. And given what I had physically gone through, nobody would do this as part of a ruse. I mean, I had a fever of over 100 degrees for 17 days. I had, you know, night sweats, dehydration, delirium, vomiting, diarrhea, vomiting and nausea. This was not pleasant, to say the least. I lost almost 10 pounds. And the doctors determined ultimately that I had been poisoned, to use their words, but through an exogenous substance which appeared to be polonium. So it's been a call back, but I, you know, make a lot of enemies. I made a lot of enemies in this campaign when I wrote The Clinton's War on Women, the definitive expose of Bill as a sexual predator, and Hillary doing the cleanup. You know, she's the one who hires the heavy-handed private detectives and the nasty lawyers to threaten and intimidate and bully the women who Bill Clinton has victimized.
Well, was it polonium that you were poisoned with, Roger?
Well, the CDC they cover themselves because they're the government, so they say polonium or a similar substance.
Oh, okay. But no, not just your casual criminal could get hold of that type of material. It took a state player here, did it not?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You can't just stroll into the drugstore and say, I want to buy some polonium.
Yeah. I haven't tried that lately. My God.
It's a highly restricted substance.
Yes.
And generally speaking, only nation states can get a hold of it, although it may be available somewhere on the black market. It is, of course, the poison of choice of the Russians, theoretically, because the spy Livnenko, who was poisoned in London several years ago, was done in with a polonium. So it just maybe I'm what they call, I don't know, I guess you could call me a conspiracy theorist, George, because it occurs to me that if you wanted to kill Roger Stone and make it look like the Russians did it, you'd use polonium. That doesn't mean, of course, that the Russians had anything to do with it. And I would like to take this opportunity to say again that the entire claim that the Russians were in touch with and were aiding Donald Trump's campaign for president is false. The entire claim by the Central Intelligence Agency and our intelligence services of emails and financial transactions between the Trump camp and the Russians are false. I don't work for the Russians. I resent being named by the New York Times in this. I have no Russian clients. I've taken no Russian money. I'm not in touch with any Russians. I wasn't during the campaign. I was also not talking to any intermediary for the Russians. I am adamantly opposed to totalitarianism. I am not a fan of Putin. I am not a fan of their system. But, George, there's one place where they've really got me. I love Russian vodka.
Oh, well, that right there is proof enough, isn't it?
Well, if you're a liberal, it is, yeah.
Yeah, if you're a liberal.
No, but in all honesty, and I say this forthrightly, either indict me. If you have some evidence that I've done something wrong with the Russians, bring a criminal indictment. Do it now. Indict me. Or write a letter saying that this was looked at and there was nothing. They should do one or the other. But picking up the newspaper on Inauguration Day and reading that my old colleague, Paul Manafort, the former chairman of the Trump campaign, and I were under investigation for colluding with the Russians, this is getting old. It's getting tedious. John Brennan, Mr. CIA, Mr. Wahhabist CIA, a man who refused to be sworn with his hand on the Bible. If you've got the goods, release them. Indict me. I challenge you. You've got nothing. Nothing.
Boy, that's terrible. It was an information war, a propaganda war against you and Donald Trump and everyone, hadn't it?
Well, two weeks before the election, five state Democratic committees all filed in federal courts in their respective states trying to halt our Election Day activities, claiming that Roger Stone and Donald Trump, he was named in the lawsuit also, were intending to intimidate minority voters. We had an extensive plan to intimidate minority voters. I'm happy to say that the court ruled against them in all five states and put no restrictions on our Election Day activities. And then they went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court reaffirmed the lower courts. So the score is, and interestingly, representing the Democrats was my old nemesis, David Boies, I had come up against him in the Bush recount in 2000 in Miami, where he was their chief lawyer. And therefore, the score is now Stone 2, Boyce 0. The Supreme Court turned him down.
My gosh. There's a bit of destiny here, would you not say? There's a day, a tragic day in the past, years ago, when you walked into the Trump Tower and everyone was crying there in the executive suite. Tell us about what happened on that day. I think there was a crash involved, a helicopter. Tell us what happened.
Yeah. Well, I was working for Donald Trump as a lobbyist in Washington. I called him early one morning and said I needed to see him on a time-sensitive matter. I had some legal language that I had worked out in a currency transaction piece of legislation that was important to his casinos. Pretty arcane stuff. But that the committee was really waiting for his sign-off, and I had to see him. And he said, well, I really can't see you today. I'm flying to Atlantic City by helicopter with a bunch of my executives. And I said, well, this is really important. I don't think it'll wait. He said, all right, come right up. I went right to the airport, jumped a shuttle. He said, I will wait for you, and then when we're finished, I'll have the helicopter round trip come back to Trump Tower and pick me up, take me down later. So while I was actually in the meeting, I rushed to New York. I got there. While I was in the meeting with Donald Trump, his longtime assistant, Norma Federer, came in and said, I have terrible news, Mr. Trump, but the superintendent of the state police is on line one for you. Donald put him on speaker. His name was Clint Pagano. I remember it like it was yesterday. And he said, Mr. Trump, I have terrible news. The helicopter that your company chartered went down in the Pine Lands, and everybody aboard has perished. And Donald Trump said, are you 100% certain? And the veteran cop said, 100%. Many years later, I found a letter which Norma Federer had written to me that said, I just shudder what to think if you hadn't called, what would have happened if you hadn't called that day and Donald hadn't agreed to change his schedule. Now, George, this is very important. I do not take credit for saving Donald Trump's life. I think I was doing God's will. At that point, it became really clear to me that God had spared Donald Trump for some higher purpose. I determined at that juncture he was going to be president, and he was going to be the man that saves this country. So, yes, this was divine intervention. Yes, I was merely, you know, being, in this case, any role I had, I was merely doing God's will. But it made me understand that Trump was a man of destiny.
Absolutely.
Who had very narrowly avoided death. Wayne Barrett, who recently passed away himself of the Village Voice, has written that the entire claim that Donald was supposed to be on a helicopter that crashed was manufactured by Trump for publicity purposes. I can tell you firsthand that Wayne Barrett was completely wrong and that was a smear.
You know, no one could have predicted this election year 2016, could they? And so many things that were God-given or God-sent happened. And this was the beginning of it, is what you're stating here. Is that not right?
Well, Trump has always been, I think, blessed with a very good luck. I mean, in a certain sense, as you know, you make your luck by the way you work and the way you focus. But Trump has been blessed with very good luck, that is even true within the context of the campaign. For example, very shortly after he made it clear that he intended to seal the borders, build a wall, and he said correctly that some of the people who are coming to this country from Mexico are rapists, are criminals, don't mean us well. Only days later, an illegal immigrant murdered a beautiful woman in San Francisco. only days after, which validated Trump's point. Now, it was a horrific tragedy, but in terms of Trump's narrative, it was a stroke of luck that that case popped up to bolster what he had been saying. The question of Hillary Clinton's health came to the fore in this election. This isn't actually in the book, but there's a press release put out by Hillary Clinton in which she blames the entire thing on Roger Stone, right-wing dirty trickster, making up this whole meme about Hillary's health. That's well and good, but then she collapsed in 70-degree weather, very pleasant, in New York City only days later. So, again, a stroke of good luck for Donald Trump, not such good luck for Hillary Clinton, but... all along the campaign, the attacks in France, the attacks in Belgium, the attacks in San Bernardino, those all stood to illustrate to the people the stark dangers of illegal immigration. So there were a lot of events during the campaign that were beyond Trump's campaign, but Trump's ability, but quite valuable to his campaign.
Right. There were so many things. The email scandal, the Bill Clinton's past was brought up, but also the WikiLeaks, and it goes on, and also the attack by everyone against Trump, and all the power people were on him, down on him. And boy, to overcome that, it just was miraculous, was it not?
Yeah, no, when I look at the forces that were arrayed against him. Let's first look at it conventionally. If she spent, Hillary Clinton, that is, spent somewhere in the neighborhood of $1.5 billion, then you have to figure that Soros, the international criminal and former Nazi war collaborator who keeps advocating the death of our president, I'm still trying to understand why he has not been arrested, because that's a crime. He probably spent another billion to $1.5 billion. But let's put her at $3 billion all in. That doesn't count the value of what I consider to be virtually advertising in the coverage of CNN. What's that worth? Hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. I mean, the commercials they sell are worth thousands of dollars, but I've seen 30-minute programs on CNN that were wall-to-wall anti-Donald Trump screed. So the entire mass media, by and large, is against him. And there's a point I think people miss. Google and Facebook are against him. They're playing games then with his ads, even as they are today, trying to minimize reach and so on. He has the power establishment of the Bush family against him, Barbara Bush, Laura Bush. Well, they had to sober Barbara up, but when she got sober, she endorsed Hillary Clinton. Laura Bush endorsed Hillary Clinton. George H.W. Bush took a pass, endorsed no one, wouldn't endorse the Republican nominee. George W. Bush would not endorse the Republican nominee. I really want to thank the Bushes because, frankly, I think that won Donald Trump quite a few votes. See, the Bushes are hated in this country, George, because they looted. They lined their pockets. Their policies drove us into war and bankruptcy. Meanwhile, they and their cronies were at the country club laughing about how rich they've gotten. The American people are fed up with the Bushes. That, I think, was demonstrated in their quick rejection of Jeb's candidacy. But what I'm trying to show, I guess, is that the establishment of both the Republican and the Democratic Party were opposed to Trump. The media was opposed. He was incredibly outspent. He probably spent $275 million all told, including independent groups. She probably spent close to $3 billion all told. It's a miraculous that the man won. It is a miracle. It is a testimony to perseverance and hard work, and to reading the electorate in a way that nobody else read it.
Exactly.
People did not understand how angry Americans were and how ready they were to do something about it.
Now, Tony Fabrizio, he called the turnout right, did he not?
He really did. One of the questions that many people ask as I move around is, how could the polls have been so wrong? Because virtually every major respected mainstream poll showed that Hillary was going to win comfortably. But the mistake they were all making, the mistake that Fabrizio did not make, Fabrizio was the Trump, one of the Trump campaign pollsters, was assuming that the turnout in 2016 would be identical to the turnout in 2012, which, of course, it was never going to be. There was never any prospect, for example, that the same number of African-Americans were going to come out, the same number of women were going to come out, the same number of Hispanics were going to come out, the same number of Jews were going to come out, the same number of Catholics, and so on, white people, black people, particularly in the area of African-Americans. It was never realistic to assume that Hillary Clinton would get the same percentage of the vote of African-Americans. Here is a dirty little secret. It's really very subtle, but it's very true. Donald Trump got 3% more of the black vote than Mitt Romney. You may sit back and say, well, that's not very much. That seems insignificant. The problem is that 3% was enough to swing Wisconsin, enough to swing Michigan, and enough to swing Pennsylvania. It's also key to note that it's not just that Trump gained 3% more, but it's that overall African-American vote was down 4 to 6% in those key states, just didn't show up. That subtle change right there wins the election for you.
Right. Here's a direct quote, and this is why your book is so great. I couldn't more than highly recommend it to everyone. Everyone go out there and get a copy of this. Here's what you say about Fabrizio. Trump's pugnacious pollster, Tony Fabrizio, saw a different model, meaning this voter turnout model. From the beginning, he assumed a lower black turnout, a surge of white Catholic Democrats who voted for Obama but would move to Trump this time, and the exodus of older white women, 53% of whom ended up voting for Trump. Fabrizio pushed relentlessly. He must have fought it in those meetings. Pugnacious, I bet he is. But Fabrizio pushed relentlessly to expand the map into Wisconsin and Michigan, as well as doubling down on western Pennsylvania in order to provide a clear path for Trump to reach 270 electoral votes, assuming, as Fabrizio did, that Trump would carry Ohio and Florida. Now, here's what I want to say in regards to what you did. You were a basically major influence and factor in getting Trump into the White House because you, along with an excellent staff, did it.
Well, really, he did it. I'm kind of just happy to have been along for the ride. In all honesty, you can't take anything away from him.
Yeah, but you've been associated with him for 40 years, and you're a friend, and you golf with him. I mean, you were more than just a colleague or an employee sometimes. You consulted with him. You're a friend.
Well, George, everything you say is true. I have great affection for him. I have great respect for him. I have great affection for him. I very much wanted him to run for decades. I very much wanted him to win this race.
Yes.
Yes, I had access to the campaign people, but I made a decision that I could be more effective on the outside, particularly because of my book, The Clintons' War on Women, which I did not want the liberals to claim was somehow a Trump-related project, which it wasn't, Trump-funded, Trump-directed, which it wasn't. I was able to do more speaking, more media on behalf of Trump, laying out why he was the right man to be president. I bet I did, without exaggeration, 500-600 media appearances, between August and November of the election year. So, but it is very important that nobody try to snatch credit for this. Donald Trump is his own strategist. And he is his own speechwriter. He is his own press agent. He is his own man. Even in the campaign mode, nobody puts words in Donald Trump's mouth. Nobody manipulates him. He is nobody's puppet, I assure you. He's feisty, and he's independent, and he will do what he wants to do when he wants to do it. Now, That is not to say that he won't listen to good advice and sometimes adopt it. That happens. But the idea that Roger Stone or Steve Bannon elected Donald Trump in the way that, say, Karl Rove elected George Bush, that's just not true. I like to believe I helped. I like to believe I helped in a substantial way, but all credit really belongs to Donald Trump.
You know, you give a gem in there and talk about his plane, okay? Not only did he pull it up to those airports and those big hangars, but he traveled in comfort where he could leave early, you said in your book, and he could return late. So, but he could rest back in his bedroom and private bath. But he had good accommodations for 43 other people that could sit in comfort. And then you contrasted that with Hillary, who had a lease plane and not nearly the comforts that Donald Trump had. So that was part of it too, is it not?
Well, of course, Trump was out there a lot more. I mean,
yes.
She did not campaign very, very hard. She deserves the Henry Cabot Lodge Jr. Award for not applying herself as a candidate.
Yes, exactly.
Look, I attribute this to her poor health. I'm sorry, the woman is in poor health. She needs help getting
exactly.
up one flight of stairs. She kept falling down. She was falling down constantly. CBS did an interview with her husband, a radio interview, in which he said, yeah, it's a problem, she falls down all the time. They edited that out before they released the interview. The woman is not well. God bless her. I hope she gets sufficient medical help. But she never had the vitality or the energy for this race. You could see that she was, coasting. They would have her campaign for a day, then she would have 3 days of rest. Then they'd put her out for a day, and she'd have three more days of rest. They were conserving her energy. It was the tip-off that she was not really well.
But there were interviews also. Diane Sawyer, ABC News, interviewed her one time and asked her for her accomplishments as Secretary of State, and she couldn't name any. That's a big no-no, isn't it?
Well, that was actually one of the few flashes of honesty by Hillary in the entire campaign.
Yeah. Oh, Roger. Man, I tell you what, you're a tough cookie. You know that?
It's been said.
And you're an honest person, too, and you're a fine person. And I've only met you a couple of times, but I've gotten to like you because you're forthright. And you know what? Trump's the same way, is he not?
He is very... non-politically correct, and I'll tell you what he thinks.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things I do in this book, George, is to document how that man, seen with Lee Harvey Oswald in New Orleans in 1963,
yes.
is indeed Rafael Cruz, the father of Ted Cruz. I outline how Ted Cruz poses as a conservative, but he is George W. Bush's brain. He is George W. Bush's brain, longtime Bush family retainer, where he does most of their resume and has helped formulate all their issues. Ted took $1.5 million loan from Goldman Sachs to get elected to the Senate. He kept it a secret, which is, of course, illegal. Took another $1 million loan from Citibank, disclosed neither one of them, and then he goes out and rails against Wall Street. Sorry,
yeah,
Ted.
Exactly.
Wall Street owns you. You're Wall Street's boy. And then he names his chief economic advisor, the man who would run the economy if Ted Cruz became president, Phil Graham. Phil Graham, the man who helped repeal Glass-Steagall.
Exactly.
Phil Graham, who gave us the last bad recession this country had with that boneheaded move.
Exactly.
I mean, you can't make this stuff up. And then here's the best part. To be Ted Cruz's finance chairman, Neil Bush.
Oh, my God.
Jeb and George's brother, the one who stole $45 million from the federal government, land fraud, in a real estate fraud. So, I mean, you got to wonder what kind of judgment Ted Cruz has.
Right.
If Neil Bush's name were Neil Stone, I assure you, he'd still be in prison.
Right. there were slogans that reoccurred. I watched most of his speeches, of President Trump's speeches, and there was the far, there was right broadcast, okay, right side broadcast that was broadcasting them when no one else would carry them or whatever. But there were slogans there that came over and over, like build the wall, drain the swamp, lock her up. But that he always ended with make America great, and then again, meaning we've come from greatness and we need to regain it. Is that what he's about to?
Well, here's an interesting little factoid. He really did want to run in 2012. He was very serious about it. I rejoined the Trump entourage as a consultant. And the fact that Romney was such a poor candidate was very disappointing to Donald. He endorsed him, but then it was kind of all downhill from there. Before the end of the year, literally days after Mitt Romney was defeated, Donald Trump had his lawyers go to the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office and trademark the phrase, Make America Great Again. He trademarked the slogan.
Right.
Only days later, would have been New Year's Day 2013, when I called him to wish him Happy New Year, he told me that he was definitely running in 2016. He felt it was his year, and that if he ran, he was going to win.
My gosh. But you know, the announcement, on the day that he announced his candidacy, he came down the escalators with Ivanka, but you know, they twisted what he said about the immigration into some racist attack, did they not?
They attempted to. Look, it is only common sense.
Right.
That says if 100,000 Syrian refugees, overwhelmingly young men, want to come to this country, is it unreasonable to assume that while many of them are good people, just looking for a better life and the promise of America, some subset of them are hostile to this country and are radical Islamists and perhaps even terrorists? That's just not unreasonable to assume. So how do we resolve this? Easy. Let's review each one of them carefully and see who they are and who their associates are and what their background is. You know, George, today, if a person applies to come to the United States, it is illegal for the Immigration Service to look at their social postings.
Golly.
You're not allowed to look at their Facebook page or their Twitter feed. If somebody is on Facebook saying, Ali Akbar, death to all the Jews, I don't want them in the United States,
right.
You know, and either should the government. So, as Trump has said from the beginning, we need a better system of immigration to be able to vet each person who wants to come here.
This Ninth Circuit ruling just recently, they overstepped their powers. They stepped all over the president's power to regulate and immigration. Did they not?
Yeah, it's a political decision based in politics, not based in law.
No, it's not based in law.
I hope the judge is happy. He's gotten his 15 minutes. A year from now, nobody will remember who he is, and 10 years from now, you know, he'll be a memory only to his own family. So. It is absurd the way the judicial tyranny in this country has usurped power from the other two branches of government and reserved them unto themselves. The courts have overreached without any question.
Yeah,
and I'm hopeful that Trump will now triumph in the Supreme Court.
Right. The alternative media, you state in your book about Drudge, Alex Jones, WorldNet Daily, Breitbart, Michael Savage, Rush Limbaugh. And then I added in here in my little note, Zero Hedge was pretty important, and Veritas with John O'Keefe. I mean, all of those, the mainline media was sidetracked because evidently the public's awareness level is up a little bit higher than that mainline media could discern. Is that right?
I think what's happened here is we've reached the tipping point. You now suddenly, and the explanation is technological.
Right.
Now that we're getting our information on our handheld device,
exactly,
that we're not staying home to watch a television set, Well, it's so much easier to get alternative mediums on your handheld device. Even if you're going to watch CBS on your cell phone, you've still got to go through the internet to get there. Well, when you go to the internet, you realize that CBS is only one of hundreds of choices of things that you can read or listen to. And therefore, people are finding their way to Breitbart or InfoWars or Daily Caller, or and when it comes to the strength of talk radio, you've got Rush and you've got Alex Jones and you've got, you know, Michael Savage, and you've got shows like this in every market.
Then Trump ran a communications race or campaign. Would you describe it that way then?
Yes, absolutely. So this shift to the alternative media, where what's really happened, George, is the monopoly that the mainstream media had on political information has been broken. The monopoly's up. There was a day, you remember this, where there were only three networks, ABC, NBC, and CBS. That's it. If it didn't happen there, it didn't happen. There was no alternative. Then Fox and CNN come along. Well, the problem is, over time, they get to sound just like the three networks. Fox has its moments when it is, you know, reporting real news, but now they've become more like the networks than like the cable system.
Well, did Hillary run a gender or identity race or campaign? How would you describe generally her race or campaign overall?
Well, first of all, she ran a terrible campaign.
She ran
a campaign that was locked in the 1980s. It was all words and symbols, but she put forward no real proposals. And I think they were vastly overconfident. I mean, I think she wanted Trump. Of all these Republican candidates, she wanted Trump as her opponent. Well, you know what? Jimmy Carter and his chief political operative, Hamilton Jordan, you can read this in Jordan's biography, they wanted Ronald Reagan. This guy Reagan, he's a simpleton from the West. He's a cowboy movie actor. We'll slaughter this guy. So she wanted Donald Trump. You know, sometimes be careful what you wish for; you may get it. In this case, he ran a very aggressive, grassroots-oriented campaign. She ran a very expensive campaign, but she herself was so cold, so aloof, so disconnected from the electorate. She always looked to me like a woman who just wanted to get out of the room as quickly as she could. She never looked like she was having a good time.
The arrogance
of calling people who supported her opponent deplorable. I mean, I'm proud to have been named as one of the deplorables. Absolutely proud of it.
You know, you say fly over America in your book.
Yes.
Well, that flyover country is middle America, and I guess they only think the East and West Coasts count, right?
That's all they care about, absolutely.
Yeah. And you make I looked that up, you know, flyover America, because I've flown over it quite a few times since 2006, looking down there, and now I can imagine how they look down on the deplorables living in the middle America, right?
Well, Hillary didn't really like staying in any of these small Midwestern states, largely because they don't have any 5-star hotels. And she insisted, going back to the Clinton Foundation days, that she move in absolute luxury. Private jets, 5-star hotels, cut flowers, the whole thing. One of the more interesting things was the way that this campaign finally exposed the Clinton Foundation, which is not a charity, but a slush fund for grifters. I mean, it's just, you know, $6 million for Chelsea's wedding, paid for by the foundation. That has to be illegal. That's essentially, they took something of value from a nonprofit to their personal benefit. Why they haven't been prosecuted for that, I still don't know. This was a quid pro quo operation. In other words, the real purpose of the Clinton Foundation is to be a vehicle for the facilitation of multi-million dollar bribes. If Hillary had a decision on her desk about uranium, for example, you pay the Clinton Foundation enough and you can get whatever you want on that decision. They were selling their governmental authority for money. It's highly illegal.
They were accusing the Trump campaign and followers and supporters for what they were guilty of, huh?
Well, they tried to make a big deal with Trump University.
Yes.
Trump University was a mail order school that Trump had been involved in. A small number of the people who had gone through the course were dissatisfied and wanted their money back. That was really it. Contrast that with Laureate Education, a multi-billion dollar scam in which Bill got an enormous amount of unreported income, which he never reported as required by law, and millions of dollars were stolen, and hundreds of thousands of students were defrauded. It makes Trump University look small time in contrast, but the media talked endlessly about Trump University. It was very hard to get them to talk about Laureate University, where the Clintons had perpetrated much, much larger crimes.
Right. Isn't there some scandal or controversy now about apartments being made in Haiti? Has that just come up on your channel, I think, on your reporting just recently?
Yeah, this is really outrageous. As I think most people know, after the earthquake, Hillary Clinton dominated all the federal cleanup money going to Haiti. Bill Clinton got himself appointed special ambassador to Haiti, and they put him in charge of rebuilding the country. They raised billions of dollars from charities and good people all around the world to help the people of Haiti. And Hillary spent billions of dollars in federal money. George, virtually every dollar of that money was stolen. No housing got built. No, nothing got built. No roads, no schools. They had a terrific problem with cholera, but nothing was done about that. The Clintons essentially, working closely with a rogue government in the Bahamas, stole everything. And now, and Donald Trump hit it hard in the campaign and said he was going to be a champion for the Haitian people. Now, suddenly, Omarosa, the White House aide who is of apprentice fame, convinced the president to send a White House delegation to go to Haiti this past Monday and put the rubber stamp on a regime that has been fraudulently elected in two elections. They stole both of them. They are closely associated with the narco traffickers. Guy DeFilippe, who is the largest and most notorious drug dealer in the country, campaigned openly with the new president, Jovenel Moise. This guy is a front man for the same gang that ripped off the country. This guy is a front man for the Clintons. Why Donald Trump would lend his legitimacy to this is a real question, but Omarosa, who works for him, is giving him bad advice. He is helping out a bunch of crooks and narco traffickers in an illegitimate government. They want him to rubber stamp the viceroy that they're putting in to run Haiti. He needs to fire her, and he needs to order his Secretary of State not to recognize this new rogue state.
Right. There are other questions arising, too. That's a good point, about Elliot Abrams being considered for Undersecretary of State. What would your comments be on that?
Hold on a second. I'm about to lose my breakfast.
What's that? Really?
I said, hold on a second. I'm about to lose my breakfast. No, that idea makes me sick.
I know, because he's a neocon and all that, right?
He is the worst of the neocons. Why don't we just give the job? Why don't we just give the job to Richard Perle? I mean, this is ridiculous.
Exactly. He's my gosh.
Trump ran against the neocons. Trump is opposed to the 30 years of endless war that they have given us.
Right.
You know, the shoot first and ask questions later mentality of the neocons. That Elliot Abrams would actually be under consideration for this job is shocking and disappointing. I'm hoping that, like with Mitt Romney, his potential appointment has no legs, I'm hoping.
Bill Kristol's calling anyone that's against that appointment as anti-Semitic or stuff.
Bill Kristol was for Hubert Humphrey. What does he know?
Right. I mean, it's a whole same gang, and people that are have been supporters of Trump are a little wary about some of the people surrounding Trump. This is a real concern in a way.
There are a few bad actors in the House. There are a few establishment types who have managed to weasel their way in. But, I mean, just yesterday I had seen, you know, Bill Kristol criticizing Trump, comparing him to Nixon in a way. And my response was, well, Bill, what would you care? You voted for Humphrey. I mean, he's an odd fellow, Bill Kristol. Friend of mine. I like him, but I just don't like his politics.
Right. In New Orleans back in October, you stated some five or six things that Nixon accomplished. And I can't remember those things. But the public doesn't know about some of this, do they? Huh?
Well, no, look, he was both very great and very flawed, but he does reach a strategic arms limitation agreement with the Russians, assault agreement.
Right.
He opens the door to China. He ended the Vietnam War on a faster timetable than the Pentagon wanted. He gave us our first rudimentary environmental protection at the EPA. You can't blame him for the way the EPA has run out of control, run amok, since the years of Nixon's death. This is not the EPA we have today that he envisioned, but in 1969 we had no environmental protection. People were dumping stuff in our lakes and our oceans and our rivers. People were you know, burying radioactive material. You can't do those things anymore, thanks to Nixon.
Yeah, Love Canal was there, yeah.
You know, he desegregated the public schools. People think it was Lyndon Johnson. It wasn't Johnson. When Johnson left office, 85% of the public schools in the country were still segregated. And it was Nixon who desegregated them, launched the war on cancer, saved Israel in the 1973 war. The list goes on and on and on. Sure, he made egregious mistakes, but overall, a real record of accomplishment that you can point to that Barack Obama certainly cannot live up to.
You stated one time that John Dean was behind the Watergate. Is that your still opinion?
Yes, he is the man who planned, pushed, and then covered up the Watergate break-in. He perjures himself repeatedly in his Senate testimony. He also perjures himself in the depositions when he's questioned by the State Department. He's a weasel. He's an absolute weasel. And he very, very skillfully misled Nixon, and he very skillfully laid the blame on others. He puts out a book. He put out a book saying it was the definitive book on Watergate, and that he has transcribed all of the taped conversations between Nixon and his aides, including many that have never been publicly brought out. Well, I go through the book and I find out that the conversations of March 16th, 17th, and 22nd, all of whom precede his soliloquy, "Mr. President, there's a cancer on the presidency," those conversations are missing, Zork. And when I go find them, you know what? There are proofs that John Dean is the guy pushing the cover up.
I got you.
Anything where he looks like a bad actor, he simply, edits it out of the narrative. And then it learned that his buddy out of Wisconsin, Stanley Cutler, now deceased, he publishes a book of the transcripts. He takes a conversation between Nixon and Dean, actually takes two conversations. He combines them. He changes the order of the paragraphs to make it look better for Dean, to make it look like Dean did not. He was the one telling Nixon to cover up. He was Nixon's lawyer. He was Nixon's lawyer, and he was telling Nixon to commit felonies. So Dean is a bad actor. I have exposed him in my book, Nixon's Secrets. I have a updated book on Nixon be out next year. Frankly, George, I've been praying the guy would sue me. He sued a lot of other people who don't have the resources or the guts to fight him. I wish I could sue him because I'd like to question him personally under oath about Watergate.
You would love to have discovery, wouldn't you?
And then it would be over.
You'd love to have discovery on John Dean, wouldn't you?
Yes, I would.
Huh? Because you could dig in. Yeah, he wouldn't go to court with you. He's not going to do that.
No.
Now, how about this continuing attack on President Trump? This Berkeley, California, and also up in Oregon. I mean, what they're not letting up, are they? Huh? His opposition?
No, I think we're in many ways it feels like 1968, where
exactly.
You have, and some of these demonstrations are they're sincere people who have real concerns about the country, and they're buying into the mainstream media caricature of Trump. I was in New York last week walking down the street, and I saw, waiting for the light to change, and I saw out of the corner of an eye that there's a couple off to the side. He's got a beard. They're younger. They keep pointing at me, and they're talking. And finally, the guy comes up and says, "Are you Roger Stone?" I said, "Yes, I am." And he said, "Can I ask you a question?" I said, "Sure." And he said, "Aren't you afraid that we're likely to have a nuclear war with Donald Trump as president?" I said, "No, actually, I think we were far more likely to have one under Hillary. In fact, she'd already agreed to it. We were going to go to war over Syria."
Exactly.
In fact, so I think by electing Trump, you've avoided nuclear war.
Well, is Trump going to work with Putin on the Syrian question? You think that's going to work out?
Well, a widened proxy war at Syria and a nice no-fly zone, George, that's an invitation for World War III, that's what they have in mind. No, I think we have to have some kind of negotiated peace. Trump is the peace candidate. Trump favors negotiation and detente over war. It's a total juxtaposition of the party. They used to accuse us of being too tough on the Soviets. We used to accuse them of being soft on the Soviets. Now it's the other way around. They say, "We're soft on the Soviets." We're not soft. We just don't want war. I mean, the country has deep financial problems. We can spend our money on roads and tunnels and highways and airports and hospitals and schools, or we can spend our money on bombs and missiles and tanks and guns. Any way you look at it, the money's got to be borrowed. When we made our incursion into Libya, probably one of the bigger mistakes this country's ever made, the bombing itself cost $1 billion. We don't have a billion in cash. We had to go borrow the money to bomb Libya.
Gosh. How about the White House? Is it leaking? Are there leaks in the White House? Because there seem to be these transcripts that are popping up. And then there was that attack in Yemen that may have been outed before the attack, to give the rebels forewarning. What do you think there?
This is what happens when you hire people who are not loyal to your mission. Yes, the White House is leaking like a sieve. I think it's awful. You do a huge disservice to the president when you work for him, but you leak in a way that is detrimental. If you had a White House of Trump loyalists, there'd be no leaking. I believe leaks are coming out of the Reince Priebus RNC press corporation that's now been moved over to the White House.
Right. The reform of the presidential the press there in the White House press. What do you see happening there in the White House as far as the press goes?
Well, technically, of course, the White House Correspondents Association controls who has credentials for the White House press room. I'd like to see more alternatives in the room. I mean, in all honesty, I would revoke the CNN press passes because they're an opinion. This is for news organizations. They're not a news organization. I would not let them send anybody. And if they physically showed up and tried to force their way in, I'd have federal marshals eject them. This is for news organizations. I note that Breitbart has a media pass, has a White House press pass. I assume other alternatives will get them. I think that's a healthy thing. Why should we only have questions from the three networks and a handful of newspapers?
Right, and even I think there was someone that put up the forward that may be a blog or something might be allowed in there, some kind of blogger or something. But yeah, we need that alternative press in there to tell us the truth, right?
Well, and ask the right questions, because as you
and,
know,
yeah, hard questions, yeah, too, to Spicer, yeah. So that's good. You know, there was one point here I was going to bring up, and I wanted to let you know about it. Sol Stern, who was one of the founders of the free speech movement at Berkeley, okay? In 2014, he wrote an article. It castigated the University of California at Berkeley. He said what they started out in 1964 of free speech has turned into suppression of the speech. And this far left, they're out of control, or what's wrong with those people?
That's exactly right. My good friend Milo, who I'm going to be getting together with in South Beach, I think, next week for a little celebration. I think Alex Jones is going to come down. It's going to be like the three horsemen of the liberal apocalypse. he was shouted down. There was violence.
Yes.
When he attempted to speak. See, liberals love free speech as long as it's theirs.
Right, right.
They don't have much tolerance for free speech if it's not theirs. That is the great hypocrisy.
Well, you make a point in your book about the mentality of liberals, and you're saying that maybe they translated into some kind of religious type of a level or something.
Well, I think it's Ann Coulter who says liberalism is a mental illness. I think that's pretty much true. The hysteria over Trump's election, which is still not abated, even a little. They're still hysterical, like the election was yesterday.
You say in your book, ideology is confused with morality or religion that takes the place of moral objectivity. And you go further. You say if one disagrees with a liberal view, then one is a danger to the world. Have the Alinskyites played that to the hilt?
Oh, there's no question. I mean, I've had, as I move around, people recognize me from InfoWars or from Fox, from television. They recognize me as a Trump supporter. I mean, I had a woman who was, probably in her 60s, impeccably dressed in Chanel, well-coiffed, the perfect shoes and so on, standing at the street corner waiting for the light to change with me. She looks over at me for 1 second. Just before the light turns, she spits on me, and then she crosses the street. I must tell you, I rather enjoyed this. There were about, 50 demonstrators outside the Trump Tower the other day, pro-Trump demonstrators.
Right.
Demonstrating for the president.
And
as people are walking by, individual, pedestrians are either saying yay or nay. They're cheering or they're saying, give up, no. Finally, this kind of cool black guy shuffles by, and he looks at him and he says, "You're all in the stone zone. That's your problem. You're all in the stone zone."
Well, I'll tell you what, we got to bring it to an end here, Roger Stone. But thank you so much for being with us this evening. And boy, you ended on the stone zone, right? But
well, the key thing, George, yeah. I want to get this book on the New York Times best-selling list.
Yes.
Because that would be a thumb in the eye to the establishment. We're very close. So I hope folks will go pick up The Making of the President 2016. It's now at selected Walmart stores as well as Barnes & Noble and Amazon and so on. But please buy this book. I think you'll love it. If you love politics, you'll love this book. And I really want to stick it to the New York Times. So give me a hand.
We have all the click-offs there at the stonecoldtruth.com and all those other click-offs for you. And, boy, we're in support of you 100%. But thank you very much for being with us, Roger.
George, great to be with you again. Many thanks.
Good night.